Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Kirk Hansen, Executive Director of the Markulis Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. It is my pleasure to introduce Charles Ferguson, founder and president of Representational Pictures and author of Predator Nation, Corporate Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America. Charles received his undergraduate degree in mathematics from UC Berkeley and his PhD in political science from MIT. While conducting his postdoctoral research at MIT, Charles also consulted for the White House, for the Office of U.S. Trade Representative, the Department of Defense, and several U.S. and European high technology firms. As an entrepreneur, he founded Vermeer Technologies in 1994, which he later sold to Microsoft. Following the sale of Vermeer, he served as a visiting lecturer and scholar at MIT and at UC Berkeley, and spent 3 years as a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. In 2005, he formed Representational Pictures and began production of No End in Sight, The American Occupation of Iraq, which won a special jury prize for documentaries at the 2007 Sundance Film Festival and was nominated for an Academy Award in 2008. In 2010, his second feature-length documentary, Inside Job, won the 2011 Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. Charles is currently working on his third film. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Charles Ferguson.
So if it's okay, I'm going to speak sitting down and not at great length because I think it would probably be more interesting to have a discussion with you and understand what you're interested in with regard to these questions. So let me just say something about why I wrote the book, what's in the book, and connect it to the kind of larger scale issues that I think preoccupy many people these days about America's economy and political system. So I wrote the book for two reasons. One is that we're now 4 years after the acute 2008 financial crisis and 2-3 years after I made my film about it. And in the intervening period, there have been two notable depressing developments. One is that as a result of primarily private lawsuits and a small number of government investigations, a presidential commission, a couple of congressional investigations, a few SEC cases, et cetera, through those processes, and I would actually say the private lawsuits are the most important and most revealing in most cases, we now have a substantial documentary evidentiary record about what was going on inside the financial system. And we now know that it was both extraordinarily unethical and extraordinarily criminal. And the second depressing fact is that absolutely nothing whatsoever has been done about this. And so I felt that it would be useful to lay out in one place in a kind of comprehensive way, make the case about what went on here and say something about the dangers, in my view, of not recognizing and responding to the nature of that conduct. It is still the case that there's not been a single criminal prosecution of a senior financial executive or of an institution as a result of the behavior that led to the housing bubble and the financial crisis. And in the book, I go through a considerable number of specific cases. And so there's a lot of naming names, And a lot of quoting from depositions and quoting from emails and quoting from memoranda. And in the service of making the point that this really was, the behavior that led to the crisis was, of course, there were people who were acting sincerely but misguidedly, but there was also a great deal of conscious, known, explicit, deliberate fraud. And the level of it and the quantity of it, I think, you know, there's no way to run this experiment, thank God, but I think that it contributed materially to the size and gravity of the bubble and the crisis. That is to say, even in the presence of deregulation and the policy environment that prevailed by the 2000s, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, the banning of regulation of derivatives, all of the other deregulatory policy measures that were taken. Even in that environment, if you had simply enforced the law, you would have had a much milder bubble and a much milder crisis, I think. Of course, it's a subjective conclusion, but I think that anyone who goes through this material as I have and as other people have as well, it comes to a similar conclusion, that there was really an awful lot going on, that it had very large effects. So that's the first reason that I decided to write the book. Second reason that I decided to write it is I wanted to connect what happened to the financial sector and its results, the bubble and the crisis, to the wider question that so many of us are grappling with these days, which is there are two related things: the growth of inequality in economic inequality in America, and the rise of serious economic problems for a very high fraction of the American population and American institutions, the American government, the national debt, et cetera, and the way that we all feel that our political system has kind of gotten out of control. The clearest, kind of most evident symptom being the rise of money in politics in America over the last 30 years. And so I felt that I had, you know, something to say about that. And so there's an argument in the book about how this began, had its roots in the first appearance of America's economic and competitive difficulties as a result of the rise of foreign national competitors and the beginnings of globalization, and how American business responded to those challenges in the late 1970s and early 1980s, which was, in many ways, in part through efficiencies and productivity growth, but also in part through starting to use money to influence politics in ways that, at least in the post-war period, had not been seen before. And between the late 1970s and presently, as a result, the amount of money used in a typical congressional campaign, either for the House or for the Senate, has gone up by a factor of 20. And the same is true of presidential races. In the 1976 presidential race, the campaigns of both of the main party candidates, their combined total spending was less than $100 million. And this year it's going to be about $2 billion. So this is that's the kind of most obvious thing. But there are many other things that are less obvious but perhaps equally damaging, and they're all part of what we sense, what many of us sense, is kind of the same issue, but it's difficult to name it in a single way. So other symptoms include the divergence between private sector and public sector salaries, which used to be relatively close together, but which now are vastly different. The rise of revolving door hiring, of hiring of government officials at at high levels, particularly to become lobbyists and advocates for industry. And the rise also of money in academia, and the rise of academia as kind of a third pillar of this system, where the revolving door is now kind of a three-way thing between academia, government, and business. And so the book includes a very detailed examination and argument of those things. And I argue, as many people do, I think, you know, if you come here, Joe Stiglitz, next month, you'll hear very similar things from him and many other observers. Paul Krugman, Simon Johnson, feel that this country is taking a wrong turn now, and that the direction that we're headed is both dangerous and antithetical to America's historical position and role and characteristics as a country that provided opportunity for all, particularly through the education system. So with that, I'd be happy to address any and all questions and specific issues that might interest you.
Let's first start, if we could, Charles, with your motive for doing both Inside Job and the book. What were the things that outraged you that led to the motivation to take this package of issues, this experience on with the kind of strength that you have?
It actually didn't start with outrage. You know, in September of 2008, when you had, you know, pretty literally when you had 10, 20, $50 billion institutions failing on a daily basis, September of 2008 saw Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac taken over by the government, the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, the collapse and rescue of AIG, the collapse and acquisition of, I think it was Washington Mutual, the collapse and acquisition of Merrill Lynch by Bank of America, and the near collapse, the effective collapse of Citigroup. When that happens in 1 month, you know, someone with a policy background, in fact, just about anybody, kind of takes notice. And I was fortunate to have some friends who were among the early observers and warners about this situation. Two of my friends are Charles Morris and Nouriel Roubini. Nouriel, all too aptly named Dr. Doom. And Nouriel had been screaming about this to me and many people for a couple of years, and I actually discounted Nouriel a little bit because, as someone correctly said of him, Nouriel has predicted 14 of the last three recessions. And so, you know, when Nouriel screamed, but then Charles Morris wrote a book, and he wrote this book in 2007, a remarkably prescient book. He wrote a book in 2007 called The $1 trillion Meltdown, which was published in February of 2008, before Bear Stearns collapsed, which was in March of 2008. And Charlie sent me the book. I've known Charlie for 20 years now. And Charlie's, you know, not like Nouriel. And that book was like really scary. And I remember calling up Charlie and saying, you know, Charlie, this is, you know, very scary and very convincing, and I know that you're a reasonable guy, but is it really that bad? And he said, Charles, just wait. And, well, you know, it happened. And so, you know, I had an appropriate policy background to look into this. And I decided to look into it before I became outraged. But when I started looking into it, I got outraged. And, you know, I just thought, this is crazy. I mean, you know, if somebody had told me in early 2008 that it, not only was it legal, but it was massively and widely practiced for investment banks to create and sell securities with the intent of profiting by betting on their failure, I would have said, no, you know, that doesn't happen in the United States. Well, turns out it does. And it is legal. And it's, by the way, it is still legal.
Question about you as an artist moving from policy work to filmmaking and now to authoring a book. Why did you make that move? Had you always thought about films as a vehicle and a media for your own expression? Or tell us the story of how you made that transition.
Well, I've been obsessed with movies since about age 8. And in high school, I occasionally cut class to go to the San Francisco Film Festival. I love movies. I've always loved movies. And I reached a certain point in my life where I had no immediate obligations, and I'd made some money from the company that I started and then sold. And so I just thought, you know, what the fuck? Mm-hmm. Oh, this is...
Radio broadcast. Are the...
Sorry.
Bleep.
I won't do that again. I won't do that again. I promise. But, it turns out that making movies is every bit as fun and crazy as people say it is. There's nothing like making movies. It's really great.
I'll get the other artist question out of the way, and we'll go back to the financial questions. But the other artist question here is, are movies, documentaries, an effective way of raising social questions like this? There certainly is a new spate of documentaries on difficult issues in Hollywood the last 10 years.
Yes, that is true. Documentary films have raised their profile significantly and in significant measure, and in part thanks to the work that Michael Moore did. I criticize Mr. Moore's films in some ways, but he did, through his films, make the point that you can investigate serious issues in a way that can be entertaining. And it might seem like that's, you know, an obvious or unimportant point, but actually it's a very important point, especially for movies. And one thing that I tried to do with Inside Job was to make it look cool and make it funny occasionally, even while it's obviously about something that, A, can be really dull, and also be really depressing. But, you know, I there's some humor in it, and there's some cool cinematography in it, and there's even some Peter Gabriel music in it, and, you know. And so as to whether it's effective, I hope so. By this point, it's difficult to tell how many people have seen the film, but because it's been on television and so on, and, you know, how many people watch it, and you don't really know. But it appears that in the United States, somewhere around 5 million people have seen the film, and globally, 2 or 3 times that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've reached a significant number of people.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what motivated you to go forward with the book, which, as you said, was in part the fact that no one had gone to jail or no senior person. So there are several questions which want you to name the people that you think ought to go to jail. So would you like to start the list, or perhaps by category? And why? Why should they go to jail?
Well, the book contains many, many, many examples. So, you know, if you're in the mood for the 7-course meal, then that. But I'll give you, you know, a little appetizer. It's a very long list. I mean, I'm not going to keep you here for 3 hours naming everybody. But just to give you a couple of examples, the three largest categories of clear offenses were securities fraud, accounting fraud, and Sarbanes-Oxley violations. So securities fraud is if you create and sell a security, you have to tell the truth about what it contains, and you also cannot omit material facts about the security and its value and so on. And they did that all the time. I'm like, everybody did that. It's the only question there is how far up the management chain you can find clear evidence that people absolutely knew in advance what was going on. The working level people, no question. Their managers, no question.
This is the knew that these securities were made up of loans that were simply of a different risk profile. than they claim to be.
And yeah, and that the prospectuses contain lies and material omissions. Yes. Yeah. So a typical falsehood in a prospectus was, we not only did the lender from whom we have purchased these loans do appropriate due diligence, but we did our own due diligence, and none of the loans in this portfolio contain, you know, the following X characteristics, and there's various characteristics for measuring what makes a relatively safe loan. So, in the case of Bear Stearns and Goldman Sachs, we have email trails, which are in the book, that go all the way up to very senior management, not quite to the CEO, but to the level below. That's not to say that the CEO didn't know, but we don't yet have public evidence that the CEOs knew. But we do have evidence that very senior people knew, and they're named. And they include, for example, David Vinier, who's the CFO of Goldman Sachs. So that would be one example. Now, accounting fraud is you run a company and you have to make public statements about its financial condition. And you make those public statements to prospective investors. You make them to the public. You send documents to the SEC. And, you know, you have to tell the truth. It's a public company. And lots of lies about these companies' financial conditions. All these guys were engaged in a Ponzi-like activity, Ponzi-like in the sense that it was something that was guaranteed to be unsustainable. Housing prices could not keep going up 20% per year, you know, forever. And you can't keep selling mortgages at that volume forever. You know, eventually, as I say at one point in the book, you know, by 2006, you were at the point of if you were going to keep up your volume, you were going to be selling mortgages to pets and aliens and dead people, and you know, kind of like Chicago voting. So they knew that they were doing something unsustainable. And they knew that it would end in tears, not only for the economy at large, but for their own firms, in many cases. And there's various ways we know that, and there's evidentiary records about it now too. And they lied about the condition of their own firms for various reasons. And then Sarbanes-Oxley violations, the Sarbanes-Oxley law kind of reinforced the laws against accounting fraud by stating that the CFO and CEO of each firm of a public company has to certify the accuracy of their financial statements and also the adequacy of their internal financial, their internal corporate financial controls. And to say that internal financial controls were somewhat lacking during the bubble would be, you know, a very vast understatement. And there's now very explicit evidence about the fights that were going on inside these firms about these questions. You know, people, honest and or scared people, were starting by 2005, 2006 to say, you know, look, we really, really have a problem here. You can't ignore this. And most of the time they were shut down. In some cases they were fired. In some cases they were harassed, demoted, et cetera. Several of them have won whistleblower suits already. I'll give you one final example. I mean, it's already a long answer. There's 100 pages in the book about this, you know. In May of 2008, a man by the name of Matthew Lee, who was a senior vice president of Lehman Brothers, so not a file clerk. He'd been at Lehman since 1994. He was the senior vice president in charge of Lehman's balance sheet globally. And in May of 2008, he wrote a memo, which he hand-delivered to four senior Lehman executives, including the CFO, in which he said, I feel that for ethical and legal reasons, I must warn you about the condition of our financial statements and the company's condition. There are tens of billions of dollars of unjustified assets on our books. And that did not stop Lehman's CFO and CEO from certifying their financial statements and the adequacy of their financial controls. And neither of these people has been prosecuted.
Were there cases, do you believe, where people really did believe that the mortgage instruments were sound and that their financial records were accurately presented? Or do you think this was a conspiracy up and down the line within these organizations?
Well, I wouldn't say conspiracy, but was it known and understood very widely that what was going on was extremely dishonest? Mm-hmm. Yes. Were there, however, and this is actually an interesting and important point, was it the case in some cases that the very senior management were kind of clueless and out to lunch and did not understand that the people below them were doing things to enrich themselves but which would destroy the firm? Mm-hmm. Yes. And I would say Exhibit A would be Jimmy Cain. And on beginning on page 112 of my book, I provide a description of Jimmy Cain and his conduct. And I urge you to take a look at it. And also, by the way, it's the Huffington Post printed several excerpts from the book, including the Jimmy Cain thing. Jimmy Cain, you know, wow. He gets some kind of prize. He really does. I mean, the helicopter golf, the marijuana, the bridge games. It's extraordinary. It's just extraordinary.
There's a question here that's related in the sense: did they really believe that housing prices would continue to rise within the industry, or what explains the basic behavior?
Well, once bubbles get underway, you make a lot of money riding them until they collapse. And, of course, you know, can you predict when they're going to collapse? Of course, a lot of people in America lost money when the bubble collapsed because they weren't able to predict that the bubble was going to collapse then. Or they, in some cases, you know, ordinary people who bought a house didn't know that there was a bubble. The banks clearly knew that there was a bubble. And the reason we can say that they clearly knew was that at various dates, it varies by person and group within the firm and by firm, at various dates, the earliest, there were some people, a couple of very early people who started betting against the bubble in 2001, 2002. In hedge funds, not in the investment banks. But the investment banks started betting against their own securities. The first one to do it massively was Morgan Stanley beginning in 2004. Morgan Stanley, a trading group within Morgan Stanley, a quite significant group, 50-person group run by a guy by the name of Howie Hubler, began betting against the bubble in a really major way. In 2004, it ended up costing Morgan Stanley $9 billion because Mr. Hubler, much like Jamie Dimon's firm recently, like J.P. Morgan just did, Hubler made a tactical mistake in the way that he did it, which ended up exposing him to losses in other securities that he thought were more secure, were higher quality than the ones he was betting against. But it's clear, we know, that he started betting on the end of the bubble starting in 2004. Goldman Sachs started in December 2006, and others at various, usually later times. A few of them really, you know, again, the top management being out to lunch issue, AIG. AIG at the corporate level just had no idea what the people in London were doing.
Several questions about why we can't prosecute or why we don't prosecute people in the higher echelons of the financial services company. How do you explain the fact that we haven't prosecuted any senior person?
Well, we haven't prosecuted any senior person because the Obama administration has decided not to prosecute any senior person. Why have they made that decision? There's different answers for different levels. It's clear to me anyway, and I think to many people that in the Justice Department, the Justice Department has been kind of captured by the industry. And so the head of the criminal division, a guy by the name of Lanny Breuer, was, before he came into the administration, he was in charge of white-collar criminal defense for Covington & Burling, which is a law firm that represents most of the major investment banks. And he had had that position for, I think, 6 or 7 years, you know, prior to his coming in the administration. But the kind of more serious question is, why is he in that job? And why isn't somebody else? And, you know, why hasn't the administration at a senior level, you know, why didn't President Obama the day after his inauguration say, you know, we're going to appoint a special prosecutor, we're going to give him $500 million, and we're going to find out what happened here? And indeed, President Obama has done precisely the reverse. How come? I wish I was President Obama's psychotherapist. It's some combination of rational, cold-blooded political calculation that this industry is too powerful and he needs them and can't afford to offend them for purposes of getting reelected, for purposes of getting other things done that he needs to get done, for purposes perhaps of his lifetime income after he leaves office. There's that. There's possibly he was captive and or captured by the advisors surrounding him in 2008 and 2009, who were people who had a lot to do with creating the deregulatory environment that led to the bubble and the crisis. Indeed, some of them had directly participated in the bubble and profited from it. He himself, when he came into office, didn't have a lot of experience with economic or business or financial matters, so he may have felt that he had to rely on these people. It's difficult for me to believe that he doesn't know better now. I can't give you a full answer. It's a tragedy for our country that he hasn't tried to do something about this.
You spend quite a bit of time in the book developing the history of how we came to have a financial sector dominated economy and politics. What do you think came first, or what created this? Was it the deregulation? Was it the tax cuts? Was it big money in politics? What came first, the chicken or the egg, or everything together?
I think that it was kind of a perfect storm in the late 70s and early 80s, and then once it got underway, it became ever more difficult to reverse as the financial sector became more powerful and American manufacturing gradually disappeared. So in the late 1970s, we had the second oil shock, which caused a lot of problems for the economy and for the country, and came only 6 years after the first oil shock, which had also caused such problems. Partially because of the oil shock, for you know, combination of reasons, we got the election of Ronald Reagan. We also had, during that period, a gradual change in the character of the economics discipline, and conservative, free market, laissez-faire economics was becoming more powerful within the economics discipline. And then we had the first deregulatory actions in the 1980s. And then every decade since, the financial sector has gotten more concentrated and more powerful. And as it's gotten more concentrated and more powerful, it's become ever more difficult to do anything to restrain it, et cetera. You know, so now I think we're in this kind of vicious circle situation where every year money becomes more important in politics and the people who have money spend more to protect their positions, et cetera, you know. And now it seems to affect both political parties almost equally. I would say not quite equally, but almost equally.
There are two or three questions which reflect one criticism that I've read of your book, which is that you miss the role of the Federal Reserve, and that it, much as Ron Paul has argued, that the Federal Reserve is really the institution which created the crisis through its mismanagement. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, my answer certainly would not please Ron Paul. The Federal Reserve was part of the problem, The way that it was part of the problem was that actually, to the Clinton administration's credit, the Clinton administration did pass one new regulatory law with regard to the financial sector in an atmosphere and a period of generally rather extreme deregulation in the Clinton administration. But it passed a law in 1994 which gave the Federal Reserve the legal authority to regulate the mortgage industry. And it was a legal authority that Alan Greenspan chose never to use. Not a single regulation was ever issued under that 1994 law until 2008, which was a little bit late.
Mm-hmm. Many questions then want to follow up on your diagnosis of some of the impacts of this on the American society. And so let's just start with the one about the inequality. What is the long-term impact of the growing inequality in American society that this dominance by the financial institutions has helped create?
Well, first and most obviously, just a lot of poor and unhappy people. And, you know, a society without educational and without economic opportunity is a society that doesn't flourish and that breeds social instability and political extremism and also social problems. You know, is it surprising that that America has the kinds of social problems that it does with drugs and so forth? You know, if there's a very large fraction of the country that really doesn't see any way out, any way up. And that's America until relatively recently, certainly until a quarter century ago, I would say, was in general moving in a direction of greater opportunity, both educational and economic, as opposed to less. In part through things like the civil rights movement and the women's movement, but also in part through explicit economic and educational policy. And that's being reversed now at a very rapid rate, at a very rapid rate. When I was an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, tuition was about $640 a year, I think. This year it's $14,000. Same is true of private institutions. When I entered MIT as a graduate student, tuition was $4,700 a year. This year it's $41,000. And with that, you know, many things have come with that. The differences in funding have affected state institutions, state universities, and junior colleges even more severely. And, you know, that's going to have an effect on our society, and it's not a good effect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Question regarding the inequality and your attitude towards the Occupy movement, the 99%. Do you see that as a forerunner of more disaffection with the system? Will it have any impact? Another question asks.
My sense is that for the moment, when I speak with Americans who are between the ages of, you know, kind of 18 and 25, the predominant political sensibility that I take away is kind of fatalism and cynicism, more than any kind of activist, you know, we're going to go to the ramparts and change things. But you know, at some point, if this process continues, I hope that it doesn't continue to this point, but the place is to look now for what the end product of a process like this can be is, you know, a country like Greece or Spain or Ireland, places where you're beginning to see, and even other places where you wouldn't expect it, even places in Scandinavia and Hungary now has a rather alarming government. You begin to see political extremism and you begin to see large-scale social unrest. You might be surprised by my mentioning Ireland in that context, but Ireland recently, the Irish government recently introduced a new tax, and over 50% of the population has joined a boycott of this tax. So people in Ireland aren't yet, you know, kind of throwing things in the streets, but the level of popular disaffection and anger is great, and it's affecting those societies in a very severe way.
For our radio audience, we're talking with Charles Ferguson, who is the author of Predator Nation, and the a filmmaker who made Inside Job an Academy Award winner in the documentary category this past year. Following up on your comment just now on the cynicism which may lie in so many people today, a question here saying, have we become a nation of sheep that simply don't see any way to fight a system? What can we do? The question asks. Is that a danger that we will lose our will to try to change the system?
I certainly hope not, and you know, I think that Americans are still a pretty feisty lot, and I certainly hope that there's sufficient, very kind of American sense of the importance of fairness and of right and wrong, even in the political sphere, that eventually will lead to something that it might look like the environmental movement or the civil rights movement, more bottom up, more popular than something that comes from the leadership of either of the political parties. Of course, many of us hoped, including me, hoped that when Barack Obama was elected that, you know, he would try to do something about this situation. And while I think that he's done some very good things in some areas, he certainly hasn't done much about this. I've spoken to a number of my political friends, and we've discussed the question, if he had tried, how far could he have gotten? And I've gotten a fairly wide array of reactions about that. Some people think that the system is now so frozen and so taken over by special interest money that it would be difficult even for the most committed and courageous president to get anything done. Others, including myself, I would say, think that we're not quite, you know, at that point yet, and that if Obama had really tried to do something about this in a really tough, serious, determined way, and had gone over the heads of the Congress to the American people, if necessary, in 2009, when the country was really in serious crisis, he really could have gotten something done. Now, of course, the situation is different, and maybe he really couldn't get anything done in the current environment.
Many of the questions track the chapters in your book, so there are several questions about the political influence of the financial sector and the influence of big money. Do you see any way out of the situation where big money appears to be dominating the political process today?
Well, of course, one can imagine a legal and policy regime that would change this situation. You know, if you had public financing of elections and very strict limitations on the nature of outside spending, the nature of campaigning, the length of campaigns, if public sector salaries were higher but came with a requirement that for some very long period after leaving public office you could not lobby for industry. You could work for industry, but not as a lobbyist. And, you know, several other such things, very stringent disclosure requirements in academia. You know, there's a menu of things that you can certainly describe that would deal with the issue. But the question is, how could you get those implemented in the current political environment? And I think that's where I think that some kind of popular movement is going to be required.
Another question regarding another of your chapters. How dare you criticize academics for their conflicts? Oh, no, that's my question. You really think academics gave in the same way others did? It was a feature in Inside Job and obviously in this book. To what extent are academics to blame for what occurred the last 5 years, and how can we control their tendency towards conflict of interest and compromise if that's what you feel happened?
Well, I do feel that it happened, and it's not academia in general. It's not all of academia. It's the financial sector spent its money wisely. It went exactly to the right place. It went not just to economics, but, you know, to the particular parts of economics that are most relevant to them, the economics of regulation, antitrust economics, finance, those, and in those domains, you will find that I would say not just a majority, but you know, I think by this point, probably two-thirds, I would say, of the leading economists in those areas have very, very strong financial ties to industry, and finance being the single most important one. There are a couple of other industries that do the same thing. Also highly regulated, highly concentrated industries dependent on government policy. So industries like energy, telecommunications. I think that the academic economics discipline does actually have a significant responsibility for what happened, both through its some sincere misguidedness on the part of economists who really thought that everything would be fine if we didn't have a regulatory structure, but with a very, very big dose of special interest money affecting people's statements and behavior.
A number of people would like to have your take on the J.P. Morgan Chase incident last 2 weeks, and what it says about what we've learned from the crisis.
Pretty clear, I think. You know, I don't know how much comment is really needed. I will say though that after my movie came out, and after I wrote something, you know, related to the movie, Jamie Dimon called me up, and I actually had a 15-20 minute, quite acerbic conversation with Jamie Dimon, in which he tried to persuade me that he was actually in favor of regulation, and that he'd been misunderstood.
Perhaps this is a related question. Because of your activism, have you faced any threats against you or your family?
I have not. And with regard to the film particularly, but I would also say something similar about my publisher, who's been great. You know, one could imagine that putting a film like this out would make somebody nervous, but the Sony Classics people, they were fantastic. They were absolutely fantastic. They gave me contractual and real final cut, and never once did they say, you know, could you tone this down? You know, they were great. Mm-hmm. And my same with my publisher, by the way. Same with my publisher.
There are three questions that relate to how you feel things have come out at the end of this. Have we, unfortunately, bought into the notion that some of these big financial institutions are too big to fail, and are we now stuck with that obligation as a country to bail them out?
Well, we are stuck with it now. We wouldn't be stuck with it if they were properly regulated and if some of the bigger ones were broken up. And actually, I will make a comment about the J.P. Morgan thing. These institutions, what the most interesting thing that J.P. Morgan proves is that these institutions are not just too big to fail. They are, as my friend Charlie Morris put it to me, they are too big to succeed. They are so large and so complicated that there's no way that you can guarantee that somebody underneath you isn't going to do something that's going to cause a really big problem. And if this could happen with J.P. Morgan in, you know, very benign economic circumstances, then what about less well-run banks in a crisis?
One question says, are we naive to think that the solution is simply to get housing prices back up there again as the solution to all of our problems?
Well, that certainly will not be a solution to all of our problems. It also isn't going to happen anytime soon. I wouldn't predict that we're going to have, you know, massive increase in housing prices anytime in the next few years. Mm-hmm.
Are we any better prepared, summary question on that, for the next crisis or the next bubble or the next tendency to misrepresent?
A little bit, I would say. I mean, at least for a while. Since deregulation began, America began having financial crises again after a 40, 50-year period of not having them. The first one in the late 1980s, then again in the late 1990s, and then the 2008 crisis. So it's been about once every decade. I think that this one was big enough and scary enough that, you know, it'll prevent people from doing something massively dangerous for at least a few more years. But memories are short, and the Dodd-Frank legislation is not impressive. So, you know, I do fear that not soon, but in another decade or another 15 years, maybe, we could face a new one.
There are a couple of questions about your prescriptions in the book, and I happen to write down the actual prescriptions. You, in the end, say that you'd like to see improved educational opportunity, the control of the finance sector and heavier taxes on them, control of the role of money in politics, reforming the tax system, strengthening antitrust, strengthening corporate governance, and a broadband like the interstate highway system. To some, those may...
And the tooth fairy.
To some people, and to this questioner, those seem, if you like, conventional liberal positions as opposed to a radical challenge. Is that how you see them?
I would, you know, I don't know whether this will enrage the questioner or not. I would go so far as to say that they're not even conventional liberal solutions. I you know, maybe even like conventional moderate solutions. You know, I don't think of myself as a particularly radical person. You know, I in many ways have been, at least. You know, this book might cause my exile, I don't know, but I've been in a number of ways, you know, rather part of the establishment. I went to MIT, I started companies, and I'm perfectly happy with the idea of people getting wealthy from being in business as long as they do it honestly.
A couple of questions about what our personal financial strategies should be given the risks that we face. Do you have any advice as an entrepreneur and business executive about what to do with your money at this point in time if at times the deck seems to be stacked against us?
Well, I, without naming any names, I do continue to have faith in America's technology sector. I think that... Facebook notwithstanding, I think that in general, America's technology sector, and in fact, Facebook is doing fine. Its IPO didn't do well. I think America's technology sector will continue to do well for quite some time. I also think that, you know, just as war is too important to be left to the generals, managing your money is too important to be left to other people.
So who do you invest it with?
I'm not going to give any investment advice. No.
There are a couple of questions about the election. At the end of the book, you say, hold your nose and vote for President Obama. How did you reach that conclusion, and are you still so negative at this point as you were when you wrote the book?
Well, with regard to President Obama's record, with regard to these issues, yes, I remain quite negative and quite critical and have in no way changed my opinion. But, you know, a president has many things to do and many issues to deal with. And in some other areas, I think that President Obama has done a reasonably good job and or the best he could in the difficult circumstances. So I certainly, you know, I think that he's an intelligent man, and in some ways, at least a well-intentioned one. And given my concern about these questions, I think you can understand how I would find it difficult to feel much sympathy for Mr. Romney. So, and by the way, you know, some of the people that I name, some of the academics that I name in the book, and who have the most severe conflicts of interest, including one who's in my film, Glenn Hubbard. Glenn Hubbard is now Mr. Romney's senior economic advisor. So, you know, I don't predict that we would have a better regulatory regime in a Romney administration. In fact, quite the contrary.
This is another question on the election there. This particular questioner checked the BarackObama.com website and found the names of John Corzine and some other donors to the Obama campaign. Do you believe that Obama or other candidates should give back money from financial figures and somehow separate themselves from that kind of influence?
Well, of course, you know, yes, in a perfect world, this is perhaps just my gallows humor, I don't know, but I'd be perfectly happy if President Obama took these people's money as long as he also put them in jail.
Several additional questions want to know what you're after next. What's your next subject? Or if you don't want to tell us exactly, could you tell us some of the topics in American society that ought to be addressed by documentary films or books like yours?
Well, there's an infinite supply of interesting and important subjects for documentary films. I am actually going to take a bit of a break from doom and gloom. Unlike my friend Nouriel, it's not my life passion. I'm actually going to make some films that are just fun. I'm involved in developing one serious film. It's a feature film, not a documentary, but heavily fact-based, heavily based on the story of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. I'm working on that with HBO. We don't yet have an approved script, but we're working on it, and I'm optimistic that that will happen. It certainly is an interesting thing. I'm also working on two other films, which are completely shameless, non-political entertainments with absolutely no redeeming social or political value whatsoever.
Number of questions regarding the internet and your faith in technology and your interest in technology. One was you said that there are investment opportunities in the technology sector, and then you did emphasize the internet and broadband for the country. Why is that so important to us as a country to have that broadband capability nationwide, and how indeed will technology improve society going forward?
Well, I think that adequate broadband services are the importance of improved broadband service to the American economy is difficult to overestimate. And by the way, in the audience, there's someone here, Mark Gorenberg, who has recently been working on this subject and knows much more about it by this point than I. But so, first of all, if America is going to continue to make progress in a very globalized, very competitive world, it's going to do it by using technology and education. America's not going to have a competitive advantage, and it's not going to be a prosperous country through people physically making things or through unskilled labor or large-scale labor-intensive manufacturing. It's going to do it through technology and skill. And that's going to involve the use of enormous numbers of computational devices of many different kinds and services based on those devices and their connections to the internet. And in fact, it is already the case that the total life cycle costs of using something like a cell phone are totally dominated by the costs of bandwidth, not the cost of the device itself. And the United States is falling far behind many other nations. The average speed of personal bandwidth connections in Korea is 3 times faster than it is in the United States. And we just can't afford to have that continue. It's also important for our national security. the best way to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and on imported energy is to substitute communication for physical transportation. And we will do that better if there is a high-speed, high-quality, universal broadband fabric, both landline and wireless, that gives this country the services and capabilities that it needs.
I'll use as the last question, we have time for just one last question. This one that says, after your time researching this subject, do you end up the day optimistic about America's future or pessimistic about where we'll be 10 years down the road?
I don't know whether it's going to take 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you know, but I am optimistic that eventually America will self-correct. The book is very alarmist in some ways, because I think that the country is, for the moment, headed in a very bad direction, and in a way that's already causing a lot of harm to many people, many innocent people. But there have already been many times in American history when something was wrong, including something with America's leadership, and when the American people got irked about it and did something about it. So I am optimistic that eventually, it might take quite a while, it might even take a generation, I don't know, but that eventually we will come back on course.
I'll just express a sentiment in one of the other questions that the thanks to you from members of the audience for spending your time in depth looking at these issues and presenting it both in book and documentary form. So thank you very much, Charles.
Thank you. Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Charles Ferguson, author of Predator Nation, Corporate Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America. We'd like to thank our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.